Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Working good.
Today is...
So let me just say that I am Matt Garcia, and I'm interviewing Juan Zarate on the 24th of May, 2006. So we can begin now.
Okay.
So why don't we begin where we sort of left off. You were describing the conditions in Corona. And you were talking about your mother who boarded Braceros, and you can take it anywhere you want to go from there.
Okay. I was born and raised at Chase Ranch on February the 8th, 1934, to parents of Hermenegilda and Victoriano Zarate, who migrated from Yurecuaro, Michoacán, and this was in the 1918. They left the area because of the Revolutionary War, and my dad was identified as being associated with Haciendados in Yurecuaro. So at the time, the Haciendados and their workers, the confidant, were being killed and or disposed of during that particular time. My mom was about 17, 18 years old. My dad was approximately 26 years old when he came. So they came through and passed through El Paso, Texas around 1919. It took him about 2.5 years to travel from Yurecuaro to El Paso. They paid 50 cents to cross the border, and from El Paso, Texas, my dad got a job with the railroad, putting rails from El Paso through New Mexico, through Arizona, finishing in Globe, Arizona. And from Globe, Arizona, he traveled to Corona, where he heard there was work in the citrus, that they were in need of workers in the citrus. He came to or founded Corona, where they was heard that there was work there. He traveled back and forth to Orange County, where they were planting trees at the time. It was Orange, California. And then he went back and forth from Corona to Orange as to plant trees, and then he settled in Corona in the mid 1927 approximately. So he went back and forth for about 8 years and then settled in at the Chase Ranch, where they were building the row houses for their workers there. And there was being built out of adobe, and I guess people that knew how to make adobes made the houses. And unbeknown to us at the time, so because I was born about 8 years after they got there, and there were other people coming from Mexico. We didn't know where they were coming from or how they got there. All we knew at the time, according to what I was told, that people used to stop by to see a relative or a friend or an acquaintance. It was years later that I learned, through studies and conversation, that most of the people that were coming through the ranch were from the geographical area of Yurecuaro and Zamora, and then they settled either on other ranches, which was the Foothill, the Call Ranch, the Peppercorner, the Jamesons, and the Foothill Company, who was hiring people at the time. And they all these ranches had a kind of like a what we call a stable workforce the year around. And then there were those workers that came in to pick the oranges and the lemons and the oranges. Those kind of like were the seasonal migrant workers that came in. And that went on in the late 20s and 30s for sure, and 40s. And the stable workforce, which my dad was part of, was started, I believe, earning about $2.50 a day, then to $3. My dad was working two jobs to support four of us, and he was able to, and he was always been a person that liked animals, so he built corrals for his cows and pen for the pigs and chicken coops and for the chickens. And being that the corrals were in the middle of an orange grove, there was no problem with the feed because they all ate whatever was available.
Yeah.
And during the time that the groves were being harvested and the Bracero program came on, about three families that I can recall, including my mom, Dona Marciana, and my godmother, boarded braceros who came from Mexico to work the groves, pick the citrus, and work the packing house. The packing house work was considered like the blue collar jobs. You know, you go down there and you wear your blue uniform that they I don't know if they provided, they bought them. But they all had the same kind of colored khakis that they wore in the packing houses. And the workers, they wore what Levi's, whatever they could find.
So the, mostly women in the packing houses?
There were women in the packing houses. Which was seasonal at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the young ladies, including my sisters, worked at the packing house. And ironically, each ranch had their own packing house. It wasn't until, I believe, well, no, Sunkist was already an entity that will form as a cooperative to process the lemons.
Mm-hmm.
At the time. And this was done essentially by the Jameson Company, who established the Sunkist plant, which they in turn processed the lemons, meaning they squeezed the lemons, the machinery, the family itself was an inventor. The lady Todd Jameson,
mm-hmm,
was the inventor, a very intelligent person, developed and patented the process of squeezing the lemons and canning the lemons, which in turn they were able to ship worldwide. This came on in the late 40s, I believe. And I didn't know till later on the environmental impact that had on the environment and the water. But during the time of the braceros in the early 40s, at the Chase Ranch, my mom, Dona Marciana, and my godmother had boarders. And I don't remember how much they paid my mom, but I remember my mom making stacks of tortillas for these guys and chili like crazy every day.
So she not only housed them, she fed them?
She didn't house them. They were living in the same ranch but separate quarters.
Oh, I see. So
yeah.
But the room was elsewhere and she did the board.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she did the boarding.
So how did she get paid? Did she get paid by them, or did she get paid by the ranch?
No, they get paid by the ranch, by the border themselves.
Okay, so it was a one-to-one relationship.
Right.
Okay. Uh-huh. And you don't remember how much they paid?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
How many meals a day did she prepare?
Three in the morning, and then they pack the lunch, and then they eat to come at around after work, after they showered. It was no running hot water. It was all cold water that was used at the time. But that was kind of like once they were able to come into your house, and all of them, I remember, they were all very respectful. Yeah, that's one thing that was very unique. And then there was a labor camp, which was called the Temescal. What was it called? It had a sort of like a surname for braceros. Quarters.
Okay.
And that's where they had the major of the workers, and they're kind of like a camp. And that's what it was, a camp. Campo de los Braceros. That's what it was.
Okay.
Rancho de los Braceros, Temescal. Yeah.
How did your mother get started as a boarder?
I think the workers themselves were talking to the men folks in the ranch, and they said that it was there anybody that they could get a lunch from them or buy lunch from them. And I guess my dad talked to my mom. She was interested, and she said, well, that's okay. And at the time, I remember, it wasn't like it is now, you know, that you don't speak to strangers and stuff like that. Then it was kind of like family, I remember, because most of the people that I remember as a kid and talking to them, they seemed to be familiar of the area that my dad and mom were from. So, but I never knew. I can't remember what their names were, let alone what city, what town they came, but it appears to me that they knew what area they were from, what town they were from, and it was kind of like a friend of a friend of a friend thing. And that's the way it was at the time, you know, very protective, very respectful. It wasn't that kind of thing, you better watch him because he's a pervert or none of that. Kind of always very respectful then. And then as time went by, then, and I don't know how this came about, that my uncle, two of my uncles came, or my mother's brothers came as braceros, and they were brought in to Corona as braceros. So it's kind of like an extended family. A member came not to live with us, but to stay in the camp there, in the same housing area. And
so you were about 10 years old when all this started.
About 10, about 9, 10.
So that happened and was a part of your life for how long?
It was about 4 years, from the 40s, I was about six, 7 years old, mm-hmm. till the time I was about 9 years old. And it wasn't until 1946, then our role had changed from living in a ranch to moving to the city. A population of about 7,000, Corona at the time, and moving into town to a new dwelling, and we followed the migrant pattern. Every year after school, in June, we go to, we follow the crops, starting in Hammett, follow the apricot harvest in July, after school, June and July. Mm-hmm. Then went to Salinas, Soledad, Salinas. Finished that. Then went to Kilroy for the plums. Then came down to the grapes in September.
So, so that stopped her role as being a provider of boarding to the Bracero.
The Bracero then in that area fizzled out, and it was the contract. Then the citrus start pickers start fizzling out because people were the ranchers, like Jameson. He passed away, and he was downsizing during the late 40s, and then he died in 53, sold the land. Foothill kept on going, and I remember working Saturdays and weekends and holidays with Foothill Lemon Company as a picker, as a pruner. I think he was earning earning 72 cents an hour at the time. And but the pickers, the crews used to come from out of town. I mean, they used to bring him by bus to do the picking. The workers that work in the ranch used to haul the fruit to the packing houses, and the ladies and men then got better job by working in a packing house.
Right.
Down to about $1.25 an hour.
Mm-hmm. So how long did that continue in terms of the agriculture, the citrus and Corona? I thought it went into the 50s and 60s, but it started to change over to housing at that time? Or what was happening with the economy of that area?
Yeah. At the time, in 1945 to 50, it was still, the citrus industry didn't grow any bigger. Because all the citrus that was planted already, what was these incorporated cities, and they couldn't deliver water outside the city at the time, so that the ranches had maxed out on the water because they could only bring so much water, and so much water needed to irrigate the citrus. So then, in turn, there was a choice. Where are the water going to go that Metropolitan Water had? It's either Orange County or Citrus. Lake Matthews, which is right next to Paris, has a capacity, and that capacity had already reached the capacity. They can't put any more water in there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the early 50s that they built a tunnel from Lake Matthews going through Corona to Orange County, a huge 20 foot pipe that was built. That's because I know that because my dad worked on that pipe, and I remember he coming from work, I mean, looked like he just got out from a shower. I mean, soaking wet. His clothes, his body, his hands, his feet were just, if you've ever been in the water so long that your skin gets all wrinkled, and
right.
That's the way his was every day.
Wow.
A sweat, trench in water. And it was very dangerous. I didn't know that till later on that they had a drill, you know, that they had these huge machinery that they drilled, and after they drilled, they put this sleeve over it, and then they brought this big, huge pipe to jam it into this hole that they drilled out on the mountain. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know how they did it, but he used to explain to me how they're able to bring this machinery, and the machinery just dug this big old hole, and they just follow that the machine, and as it was traveling, they used to drag a pipe with them.
Oh, wow.
That's amazing. And it's the same pipe It's been used now for 40 some years now to transport water to from Lake Matthews to Orange County, and now it's Lake Paris. I don't know if you're familiar. Right. Mm-hmm. Lake Paris to that was the extension or the end of the extension that the water's coming in from that the canals coming in from a northern area.
So in the time of the Roseros for you, do you remember any kind of conflicts or problems with the program?
No, not that I'm aware of. Although it was in the mid-30s that there was a big influx of deportation. I remember they used to call the Pachucos, that's how they dressed at the time, and that's the way you were able to identify them, whether they're locals or not locals. Mm-hmm. But there was I wouldn't say a concerted effort of deportation, but during the 30s there was some unsettlingness in the city of Corona because of unemployment at the time. And interesting enough, there was no unemployment there in the city. The police chief, Greer, was very proud to say this, and I heard it myself, because he taught a class that I was taking way back in the early 60s, that any undesirables that he saw unfit to walk the street, he'd pick him up and put him in jail for no reasoning at all. And so they had everyone in check. You're either working, you don't roam the streets, and had a curfew. The city of Corona had a curfew, mm-hmm. which was enforced by a horn. They blew a horn. Sunkist had a horn that they used to blow.
Yeah.
And if you're not at home or you're going home when they whistle blow, you're okay. But once the horn is blown and you're in the street, you're ending up in jail.
Wow.
Kids or no kids or adults.
Did this happen to Braceros?
Everybody. Everybody.
And was it just for Mexicans or was it for everybody?
You know, it was for everybody. Everybody. But during the Braceros, because there was a tremendous amount of males in the city and they had money, there was one, two, three kind of like a what they call cantinas. Are you familiar with the term cantinas?
Yes.
They had cantinas there that the single man used to go there and patronize the cantina because they had a couple of ladies there. I won't say ladies of the night, but they had ladies there, you know. And that was a big no-no for... I remember my dad used to be questioned by my mom, where are you going, where you been, blah, 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 better not catch you in the cantina.
Yeah.
You know? Because it was kind of like a ladies of the night who work in the cantinas. And I remember Amada was her name, and there were some other ones, but Amada was the lady there who owned the cantina, and she made good money, and as she got old, she became respected, and she was okay. I'm not saying she wasn't, but she made her money out of that beer bar. And even before that, during Prohibition, and there's articles, and I've seen it myself, where the Italians, remember, they were brought in from Italy,
yes.
primarily and exclusively to prune trees. That was their occupation, their trade. They were brought in to prune trees and teach people how to prune trees. But in the sidelines, each one of those people had a cellar. And each cellar had a brewery where they pressed their own juices. And they used some, not all, some Mexicans to be the runners for liquor during Prohibition.
Yeah.
You know that?
Yes. My friend Jose has written about this.
Yeah, yeah. Even the most respected people had those. The Blondies, the, what's her name? Lanetas, Laportos. Yeah, they had their cellars, and it was well stocked. I'm trying to think of the mayor's mother who passed away, and their house was for sale. And I just went to, I was about, it was in the early 70s. I just wanted to find out for myself what was in the house. And sure enough, it had a cellar, but as big as this room, bigger than, it was the same, the house, the cellar was the size of the house, but underneath.
Yeah.
And it had the presses, the corks, the bottles, I mean, all, yeah. And, but all of them had it. And later on, I talked to a friend of mine whose dad used to be a runner for these people. And he was telling me about it. Yeah.
So the braceros, not just the braceros, but braceros as well as local men frequented the cantinas. And was that an issue for the community?
No. It only became an issue if they became rambunctious, violent, then the police came in to pick them up, you know.
Did that happen?
It happened, yeah. It happened, but it wasn't a problem.
I see.
It wasn't a problem. And it only happened in the cantinas where they joked. And I remember, because I used to work with my dad picking oranges, mostly oranges and sometimes lemons. And they used to have conversations about how did they go last night con la señora Eva. You know, and you know, you're, when you're 8 years old, your ears are attuned to what the big boys are talking, the parents are talking. And I remember they used to talk in a way that it was hard to follow their conversation, but they used to joke about so-and-so behavior the day before, the week before that, you know. And it was interesting. And the most thing that I regret now as I get older, not having conversation with my dad about his father, and what he felt working here in the United States, you know. He was of the old mind that men should work, and the females, why do they go to school? Well, they don't need to go to school. And that was the mindset that they had, that some people have even today.
And your father had that mindset?
Oh yeah.
So how did your mom take it?
Well, if it wasn't for my mom, I would have been ending up working in the citrus. So when it wasn't because my dad pushed me, but it was my mom who pushed me and pushed my dad to allow me to go to school. So when I was telling you that during the summer we left the house, migrated, followed the crops, came back in January, and from January to May or June, we were in school. So I only had about 6 months of school from the seventh grade to high school. That was 6 months out of the year. And came 12th grade, you either had two choices in my era. Either you work in the citrus or the packing house or go to the service. So that was the only two choices. It wasn't, can I go to a junior college? I want to get a job. There wasn't any.
What did you choose?
Army. So there's five of us that graduated from high school on June the 15th or the 12th. 10 days later, June the 23rd, we're on our way to Fort Ord to join the Army, and then some of them got shipped to Korea, some didn't, you know. But that's the only two options you had at the time.
So did you go to Korea?
Yeah.
Okay. Just one more thing about the Bracero. Did you have any interaction with them yourself?
No, because they were much older than I was. You know, they were at that in the 40s. They were kind of like older, and maybe not even that much older. But we at the time were, I wouldn't say trained, but we were kind of taught to keep our distance, not to speak to anybody unless they spoke to you, that type of thing. So that the Braceros, there were some young ones, I don't remember too much about it, but we never mingled on the time they came to the house. And it was interesting because it was like my mom running two shifts for supper. She had us coming in early to feed us, and then we finished and went outside to do our chores, and that we all had chores. And then she brought the workers in, and they were there for just a brief moment as well.
You said that later on your uncles came as braceros. So did they stay?
No, they
went back.
No, they stayed. Seemed like a very short period of time working in a ranch. Later on, they moved to another area. It wasn't Corona. They moved to as if they were passing through. You know, they worked for a while and then they moved on to another area. But I don't remember too much about that area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we've been 30 minutes in, and I want to talk about the stuff that you did in the 1960s and 70s.
Oh.
In Imperial. So why did you get us to Imperial? How did you move from, did you come home from the war and decide to come down here?
No, it's a very easy. It's just, I got out of the service in 1956, okay. June 23rd, 1956.
Okay.
From 1956, I got the GI Bill. I said, well, I'm going to go to college. Hmm. So I went to college, got under the GI Bill, and then I went to Chaffee Junior College for a year. I said, no, this ain't going to cut it. I'll get me a job as a truck driver. A friend of mine got me a job making $1.90 an hour. Big money. So I got that job, worked for it for 1 year. I said, in 1958, I said, no, this is not for me. So I went back to school. Not unbeknown to me, when I went to work for him and then went back to school, at Chaffee College, the professor calls me up and says, hey, well, come here. We just started a new program. And when I first went to college, I took electronic technician. I took it for a year, came out, went to truck driving. That was not for me. I went back to school. So I went to school. The professor says, as I started to say, hey, we got this new program, blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah, the year that you took is equivalent to 2 years. But let me get you on this program. That'll be 2 years ahead and blah, blah, blah. Let me show you. So he took me to Chaffee in Ontario, where it was located. Went into this room next door. And huge black boxes. Looked like a cabinet where you store your computer kind of thing. It was a metal one. And you heard a big old hum. Rah, rah, big old tubes the size of a bottle, maybe a drinking water, maybe a little bit bigger. And it was the tubes. And I says, what is it? So we just got these computers from the Department of the Navy that they spared, and they got some new ones. They gave me these and want to start a program on computers. And smart me says, I'll go back to electronic tech, and that computer's never going to take off. A big, major mistake. So I went to Beckett Chafee, and then I said, well, I'll go back to electronic. And it didn't work out for me. I didn't like it. So I said, well, forget about that.
Can I pause it? Because I had someone kind of give me a signal to ask me a question. So, because I'm running the show, I got to answer the question.
Second time at Chafee College where I decided to go back to electronic technician. Things didn't work out for me in school, so I ended up getting married. And that took me up to 1958 and 59. I had my first daughter. And then in 1958, I got a job in a foundry where they hired me as a quality control clerk, foreman, et cetera, et cetera. I stayed in that position of working in a foundry where we were making cast iron pipe for sewers. They had an employment of 125 employees. Gave me the opportunity to hire all my family, of course, and friends. So that job, for me, terminated in 1963, where I went to work for the state as a correctional officer from May 3rd, 1963 until 1973. And during that particular time, I got involved with civil rights matters and
where were you a correctional officer?
At CRC, California Rehabilitation Center.
And where is that located?
Norco, California.
Norco.
It's a city next to Corona.
So then you started getting involved in civil rights?
Civil rights, war on poverty, mm-hmm. Civil Rights Act, anti-poverty programs. And it kind of, with me at before 63, kind of like a black and white thing, is that you got to work to support yourself. You go into trouble. If you get into trouble, it's because you were looking for trouble, not because you're standing in the corner waiting for the bus. But it was my mindset that things happened because you were to blame for that. Well, you know, something clicked in me and forced me to think a little bit deeper that there are classes of people, social injustices, deprived from just because you're poor, things that are coming hard to you because of your education, your social status. To me at the time, things, it kind of opened my eyes, to be honest with you, you know. Made me think twice about things that are happening around me, to the point that I got myself involved in these kinds of programs that opened my eyes to what is really going on. And to this date, I force myself not to get involved because I know myself enough that if I get involved, I'm not a person that just kind of lay back and just take the back seat. I just not geared up for that. So I just got to be careful with myself because I really don't have much time. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some other things that I like to pursue, meaning my kids, my grandkids. Because mm-hmm. during that particular time of fighting war on poverty, I missed a lot not doing things with my kids. Mm-hmm. You know. And I think it's very true with a lot of people who got involved in fighting social justice kind of program, mm-hmm. that they put the cause first before the family. Mm-hmm. And it's just because that you get involved and you get into it, you just can't easily back out, mm-hmm. you know.
So what Exactly. I want to go to the family thing. I understand that as a professor, I'm constantly doing this, and I also have children, so yeah. We won't leave that. But I am interested in what aspects of the war on poverty really kind of radicalized you and made you say, I just can't help
okay.
get involved.
I could tell you the month and the date exactly.
Okay.
March 1963. I was invited to a meeting in India. What? In India, mm-hmm. where this lady, Miss Stowers, asked me to be there, and just to be, she just said, "Just go down there and see for yourself, so you can open your eyes." She said, "She's a black lady from Casablanca."
Mm. What's her name?
Miss Stowers.
Towers.
Stowers.
S
S T O W E R. She lives on in Casablanca off of Madison. I want to say as you cross the railroad track, 2nd Street on the left, turn left, go down 5 houses.
And she's still there?
She's still there.
Wow.
She's still there.
Okay.
And she said, go for yourself and see what you see. And I saw a lot of the poverty. Like Ripley, you know Ripley?
We just came from Ripley.
Jesus Christ. I've known Ripley for 40 years and it hasn't changed one thing. The way you see it now, I passed by there November of last year. I said, shit, man. Kind of like deja vu, man. I remember going to those meetings down that way. It's bad. I mean, bad. You're talking about the South? At the time, they had a one employer there, and they treat people like shit, you know.
Who was it? Do you remember?
It was a guy that a granary. I don't know. I don't know too much about what he did, but it had a granary there, mm-hmm. and they just treat the people bad. Mm-hmm. At the time, there was a lot of blacks, poor blacks there, and it reminds me a lot like. What Julia Roberts movie, the Brnovich movie?
Oh, Aaron Brockovich.
Exactly. Yes. You talk about the era. Mm-hmm. It's right there in Ripley. McCandle is a supervisor at the time. They wanted to build a reactor. I don't know if you know that. At the time, in Blight at the time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
1963.
Late 60s, early 70s in that era.
Okay. Uh-huh.
They wanted to build a energy reactor there. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, I won't say because of us, but we raised enough hell to bring it to light that was the plan that they're wanting to do. That was one of them. Aspect of it, and it wasn't until the later 60s, early 70s, mm-hmm. that they got another idea to build what they used to call sewer to the sea, meaning they
sewer
were going
to the
sea. Sewer to the sea.
Oh, sewer to the sea.
Which bring a big pipe from San Bernardino. Through Colton, through Riverside, down through Corona, down the Santa Ana River, past the Prado Dam, so that these manufacturers could dump their toxic waste into the sewer sea and out to the ocean. That's the big project that they had in mind.
Hmm.
And that's one war.
What year was that?
It was the early 70s. Early 70s.
And you won that battle.
Yeah. It wasn't me, but it was a coalition of people. Dr. Hallstetter. Yeah. Dr. Hallstetter was involved. He was from Grand Terrace in Riverside.
Yeah.
He was a professor. Dr. Hallstetter. And there's some other people, you know.
You know Penny Newman?
Who?
Penny Newman. She's over near that area. And they had the Longfellow the Stringfellow, Longfellow?
Oh, yeah.
But it's
Spring.
Is it the Springfellow? Or
the Springfellow. Springfellow acid pits.
Acid pits, right. And yeah. So she was able to get some kind of money for what they did. And it's a Superfund site now, so they're cleaning yeah. it up.
At the time, I was working with George Brown, Congressman George Brown.
Oh, yeah.
And we helped bring that about to focus on what the acids were doing with the water that you people drink, the aquifers were getting decontaminated and so on and so
forth.
And
then it rained and it overflowed.
Still there.
Yeah.
And it's still building houses. Big $500,000, $750,000 houses. Right. And you can see from across the freeway where it's still toxic.
Yeah.
Yeah. But people moving in, they're just buying the house. They don't have a faintest idea what it all is about.
There an organization or organizations with the Ripley or the Grand Terrace battle?
No.
It was just
what happened at the time. The only organization was visible and viable was the organization called the Riverside County I knew I should have brought my papers with me. Oh God, it's you know, the early 60s they had a war on poverty programs, right?
They Remember? Used to have community action programs.
Exactly.
And it was
Office of Economic action. Opportunity.
Oh.
That was
OEO.
OEO.
Yeah.
You ever remember that?
Yeah. Oh, well, I study it.
So, yeah.
But I never. I met people that have been involved, but this is.
I was the president of the organization.
Of OEO.
OEO.
In Riverside.
Riverside County.
President.
President.
What year?
19. I would say 64. That was about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Stowers was the executive director of the Head Start program. And Head Start, as you know, is the most viable program that the federal government has for early childhood development.
She was GP?
She was the director.
Oh, director.
She was director of that. And we had other directors, the food program, the senior citizens, and then that organization helped focus the problems in Riverside County. And the Board of Supervisors didn't like that at all, to be able to get them to take care of this problem, and that's what our job was. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily our job, but to focus and identify problems in the county that are endangering or that the Board of Supervisors need to look at and address those issues. Ripley, their problem was gigantic, from water to sewage, health problem. The nearest facility, you know where Ripley is, you know where Riverside is.
Mm-hmm.
If a person of low income was need of emergency care,
they had to go to Riverside?
They had to go all the way to Riverside County Hospital downtown. You know?
That's crazy.
And if you go the other way to Phoenix.
Yeah, it's almost closer to Phoenix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's county lines and state lines, so you couldn't take them over there. So they talked about airplanes and so on and so forth, but that didn't work out. But then Alfredo, as you know, he was kind of like the catalyst and the eyes and ears for us down there, you know.
Mm.
But even that is not very helpful. Now, with the two prisons down there, it kind of alleviates the problem, medical problems, I understand.
Mm.
But the problem is still bad. not the health problem, because Palm Springs, as you probably know right now, it's probably is going to surpass Moreno Valley, where you're going tomorrow. It's growing. I mean, growing.
Yeah, I notice. And they're eating up the agriculture for homes in Coachella now. There's all these new home tracts.
Well,
so it's spreading all the way.
You can tell what the plan is now is the Salton Sea. Is that their plan now? Mm-hmm. Because the Salton Sea gets fed from agricultural discharges,
yeah,
and contaminants from Imperial County, but the water sits there. So now they're planning to devise a plan how to circulate this water. They gotta move the water,
right,
in order to help the contaminants from being spread along the lake. Now, as you drive back, you'll see some new houses going to the left. Those just been built in the last 6 months. And you think, well...
At the south end of it? Where?
Right on the...
On 111?
Yeah, you're going to come way...
It came down 111.
Okay, 111 comes this way. This is 86.
Oh.
This is 111.
Oh, yeah.
If you...
Yeah, we're... this is...
And you're over here.
Coming north.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm thinking going down. Okay, so...
It's
interesting, your perspective. I live up there, so I see the salt ice. Okay, Ontario's up here. So you're...
Ontario's Imperial? Over here.
Okay, Ontario and Imperial. Okay.
Mm-hmm. If you go down to Brawley...
Yes.
Take 86. It'll give you another perspective.
Yeah.
All this is rural.
Yeah.
All this is rural. But you come down this way, it's a four lane freeway.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to find that they're starting to develop houses along the freeway. There's an Indian casino. It's going to be right about here. And Coachella is right about here.
Right.
But what they're trying to do is circulate the water. And they're proposing to build kind of like a dike, a dam,
yeah,
if I may, so that the water comes up this way and it circulates. Because if you come at this end of the at this end, if this little break, because the dam, this holds the Salton Sea, is only about as wide as from here to the wall at the top. Two cars cannot pass. And that's the only thing that's holding the water from spilling into the hydroelectric plant, two hydroelectric plants here.
Hmm.
If that dam ever breaks and goes into these, it'd be a big explosion.
Really?
Yeah, really.
So the circulation's going to maybe...
Oh, well, that's two issues.
Okay.
The Salton Sea is 258 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
258 deep. Imperial County is sea level.
Right.
Sea level. If this break ever breaks, half of Brawley would be... No. Calipatra,
yeah,
is going to get inundated. No question about it. Nyland is history.
Right.
Yeah. And Brawley is going to be half flooded. All that air is going to be flooded.
What would create that condition?
A gopher. Hungry gopher. You mean it?
To break
this?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, anything. You had an
earthquake?
5.4 earthquake last night. Did you feel it?
I didn't feel it. I guess I'm a true Californian.
Yeah, 9:14.
Yeah, I missed it. I was here, but
oh,
I didn't
19.
Feel it. Yeah.
Oh no, 9:19.
Yeah.
I had a 5.4. We were in bed. My wife and I were in bed after we left here. And I told my wife, we had the air conditioner and the fan going. And I tell my wife, quit shaking the bed. I'm not kidding. The bed was like this. No, you're shaking it. Cut it out. No, you're shaking. And we went like that twice. It's an earthquake. And our house is a block reinforced house. And it doesn't bounce. It kind of rolls like this. And it was going like this. And the fan has a couple of chains, and I'm looking at them, they're just going crazy like this. It was a pretty good little jolt. The late 60s, had a major earthquake here. City Hall in El Centro, which was second, underneath had a parking lot. Mm-hmm. Just like they had in earthquake not too long ago in L.A., remember when the cars were parked underneath and the apartment house
at Northridge. Yeah.
Northridge. Yeah. Same thing here. I mean, the whole second floor was first floor. Mm-hmm. Just collapsed the whole thing. It was major stuff here. The reason why I say this, because I came down to see it, El Centro. I said, let me go see. Yeah, man. So all this is volcanic, you know. We had, I don't know how many exactly, how many hydroelectric plants are in here, but there's quite a few. Hmm. If you think El Centro, Imperial County has a lot, you got to go to Mexicali. I mean, that whole area is dotted with hydroelectric plants.
So you use Colorado water to do that? Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
But is it the hydroelectric on this side run through All American Canal? It's Colorado water. But
yeah.
All American Canal.
Yeah, they use the water to cool it. They got the canal. The main canal comes this way, and the hydroelectrics are on what they call the West Main Canal. Yeah. There's the big canal that comes from Yuma.
Yeah.
And they got the West End, and they got the West Side.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got laterals that come through here. The one big plant, you see it here in Heber. But they don't talk. In Heber, they don't talk. That Heber has the most cases of people coming down with cancer.
Really? What do you think is causing it?
Obvious.
But the
plant,
power?
Plant.
But what is it producing that's so toxic?
It's the metal that goes up with a steam.
In
the pipe? In the air.
So it's not in the water?
No.
It's in the air?
It's in the air.
Okay.
And then the people inhale it. The other one is the feedlot. The feedlots and the cows produce a lot of methane gas.
Yes.
And they're the highest concentration of contaminants known. That's a fact. Methane gas and the contaminants that the cows give out. You probably see this more than anybody, any place else, the water trucks, continually. That's because of the dust. They don't want the dust to go up with the steam. In the mornings here, and this stuff they don't tell you about. But we know, I know, you know, that is not good for you.
Mm-hmm.
The fine dust that you breathe in together with the moisture that's settled in the plants that you eat, they don't tell you these things.
Hmm.
Yeah.
We got a lot to talk about. I'm going to have to come back and talk to you. Let me just ask a couple.
Well, I'll tell you.
I got to come back and see you. That's just...
I'll tell you. Not that I'm trying to impress you.
Yeah.
You know. But when I tell you about the Sunkist, the reason why they relocated to an area in San Luis Obispo is because they knew that they were contaminating the water. Because the lemons and the citrus, they have to spray the citrus, the peelings. And they were doing what they were doing with the peelings is they were shaving the peelings, and the machinery they were using was stainless steel. The only thing that could clean the acidity off the machinery is what? Muriatic acid. Anybody knows the muriatic acid? If you drink it, you ain't going to be long for this world.
Yeah, right.
I took pictures. Big, huge tankers parked next to Sunkist.
What year was this?
It's late 60s. Then I went to city council because I took pictures of the tank parked next to Sunkist, and I knew what they were using, the muriatic acid, and how they were using it because I worked in it, and how they would use it in the plants to clean the machinery. Then they discharged it. And where did they discharge it? What they call settling ponds. And there's nothing growing in those settling ponds. And then if that wasn't enough, they were using the sewer pipes to transport the waste to it. And I took pictures of it.
Where was this?
Corona. I mean, people didn't like me too well. Telling you.
Is Corona Riverside County?
Very much.
Okay.
Yeah, very much. So what happened to the, because they use filters, right? Use filters to process the liquids from the acidity. It was kind of like a sandy kind of they used on it. And once they threw with it, they cleaned the vats out and they dumped it. So then what you had were piles of white stuff, which was a filtering material. Then they spread it over the fields. Yeah. But then I was like, I felt myself like a guy that, man, why are they doing this? Money. This state, you go to Corona, the plant, they're hauling the stuff out. The steel that they use for the walls, for the coolers, everything is being hauled. Where they're dumping it, I don't know. But there wasn't any changes coming about in Corona till you start analyzing the water. Because everything in Corona, and particularly Corona, because of the aquifers coming from the mountain and from Norco, comes into this one channel and forming this aquifers, and all these pumps were pumping it from this geographical area. Well, the pumps were coming in high on nitrates. And people say, well, nitrates, yeah, well, you know, have your animals, you got cows, and you got goats, and you got chickens. So you cannot have more than six chickens, six animals in your house. That's what they selling to people. But it wasn't that, it was the Sunkist people, and they knew.
And so Sunkist sold out and moved away.
Moved up to San Luis Obispo, Ventura County.
Ventura County, where?
Start business all over again. And the engineer that used to be with the city got a job in Ventura. But anyway, I'm getting off the track, right?
Well, I'll come back, but I'm curious, you know, you were OEO president during critical years for Riverside County. I wondered what your role was in the farm workers movement, or did you help them, or what exactly did you do with them?
With the farmers?
Yeah, farm workers, the United Farm Workers, because they were active in Coachella and Imperial.
Yeah.
Coachella's in Riverside County.
Yeah, it was Cesar Chavez came from this geographical area that we're at right now. Mm-hmm. He started his movement in San Luis, Arizona.
Right.
And then they had that's why he died, because he was fighting the lawsuit in Yuma that a grower filed against him. So he had to come down and face the charges. Mm-hmm. And he started, I'm not too familiar with the law part of it, the lawsuit, but I know that he started here. When he came to the Imperial County, he wasn't very well received by the growers here. They say that because of him, the vegetable industry moved their operations to Arizona because they were more friendly. So consequently, that left the ranchers in growing grass. And this is their primary crop right now. There are vegetables. I'm not saying there's not. But the main thrust right now is exportation of grass. The Sudan, the Bermuda, and alfalfa.
And where's that grass from?
To Japan. Did you know that?
For golf clubs?
No.
What do they use?
They sell grass because Japan has no land to speak of. So nearly hundreds of thousands of tons are being exported to Japan. Australia is a competitor. So if things go bad in Australia, these people make tons of money. Tons of money. Sure, you still have the vegetable people, but by and large, the grass is dominant.
That's not a labor intensive.
All machinery.
It just grows.
All machinery.
All machinery, so they don't have many farm workers.
Mm-hmm. And there is no organized effort here for the campesino because of the labor market. You have green card people lived in Mexico, come down across the border every day to come to work. So if a laborer asks his boss, "Hey, I need a few dollars more to pay for the gas." Hey, we're not going to do that. Get another one. Consequently, they don't complain. They don't complain. During the biggest paying job for the worker here in Imperial County is the irrigator. He gets paid $125, $130 a day, 24-hour shift.
Is this the Zanjero?
Yeah. And that's supposed to be the better paid job.
How many are there?
I went to a meeting last year where they were training all the Zanjeros on this new concept of wastewater conservation. It used to be the irrigators open the gate, let the water run. And there was runoff water, what they're talking about. New concept is the water has to be recirculated again. So there's a new type of barriers that they're using now to recirculate the water. And there's some efforts into conserving water. But you ask me how many irrigators there are here? Just one ranch. Has over 228 irrigators.
Wow.
Yeah, and that rancher is shutting down. Coons Farm. He was the largest exporter of grasses in the valley. By far.
So what's happening to him?
He got killed last August of last year. And today, yesterday and today, they're selling out the equipment, all the equipment.
What are they going to do with the land?
See, it was just him, the male, a brother. He was nothing to do with farming. He's a lawyer. So they're selling the equipment. The land that he has under his name, he's selling it. Mm-hmm. The land that he leased out is going back to the original owners. There's a lot of absentee landowners that rent their land out. So consequently, they're closing down their operations. Last year, because I have a friend that worked for him, and he was the person who was in charge of the amount of grasses that are being stacked. He's telling me that it had over 1.5 million tons of grass.
Wow.
You know how much that is?
1.5 million.
So 1.5 million ton of grass. That's enough. Well, if you, that's 55. Have you seen those stacks of grasses where they got them covered with tarp? You see those big ones?
They cut it off at the root.
No, what? It's just like bales. Like bales all itself, yeah, right. And they stack them up.
Right.
And
the roots are still there.
And they're still good.
Yeah.
I mean, I have some that's 2 years old and still good as it was cut 2 years ago. If it's covered. If it's not covered, then it dries up. But 1.5 million is 55 stacks, but the size of a quarter of a city block.
Wow.
One stack.
Well, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back and visit you. We'll get deeper into the OEO stuff and current conditions, changing conditions here. For this time, I think I need to go back out. I appreciate your time. We covered the repair parts, so next time we can focus on your work with the OEO. And we never even really got to how you moved down here. So we'll do that next time.
That's an interesting